Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Eric Jung, an intern at GTI.
And today we're so thrilled to be joined by Joshua Espana, a lecturer at the Department of Political Science and International Studies at the Polytechnic University of the Philippines. In addition, he serves as a resident fellow at International Development and Security Cooperation in Manila, an expert on Philippine strategic affairs, middle power politics, and security dynamics in East and Southeast Asia. Joshua is a regular contributor to a wide range of international publications. He's a co-author of the book, The Rise of Philippinization, Philippinization is Not Finlandization, published in 2021, as well as the upcoming The New Middle Powers of Southeast Asia. Joshua, thanks so much for sitting down with us today.
Hi, I'm Eric Marshall, and good evening from Manila, and good morning to Washington, D.C.
Well, Joshua, we're so excited that you could join us to discuss what's become really one of the most fascinating and unique actors in the modern Indo-Pacific, which is the Philippines. Closely aligned with the United States for decades, Manila has really recently begun to chart a much more independent path to foreign policy. Since the election of Rodrigo Duterte in 2016, the nation's relationships with both the United States and the People's Republic of China have really evolved significantly. Simultaneously, the Philippines' approach to Taiwan, a nation that is geographically proximate if not politically, has really begun to shift as well. So with all that in mind, we're so excited to have you here to share your insights on the Philippines' really complex and evolving position in the region. Well, Joshua, just to get started, I'd love to get a background on the role the Taiwan Strait plays in Philippine decision-making. You know, I think it's fair to say that while the Taiwan Strait is relatively close geographically to the Philippines, it's relatively distant in terms of geopolitics. So can you give us a bit of background and nuance on how Manila has historically approached the Taiwan Strait and how that's changed over time?
That's a very terrific question. Now, we have to stem back from the Cold War era, right? So you have the island of Taiwan, which is known as the Republic of China. Back in the 1970s, prior to the so-called One China policy, the China which we recognize was the Republic of China in the island of Taiwan because of our Cold War legacies, right? So in the 1970s, we basically bandwagoned with the United States in terms of recognizing People's Republic of China as the only China at the world stage. Now, what happened was that, like the United States and others, we basically followed the idea of ambiguity, right? So we leave the island of Taiwan alone. We preserve the people-to-people relations. We respect, de facto, the political system of Taiwan. However, when we talk about external sovereignty or the recognition of who China is that Beijing holds that trophy, if you know what I mean. So when you talk about Taiwan, we basically just acknowledge that they are there geographically, but geopolitically, we need to consult the People's Republic of China for any concerns, which is, I think, the People's Republic of China made a good narrative about this, that this cross-strait relations is but a kind of internal matters. You know, the People's Republic of China has excellently created the narrative that this is but an internal matter. But things are changing, actually. If you look at the dynamics, the political dynamics of Taiwan, I think the 1992 consensus by which the government of Taipei and Beijing had agreed on the fact that no one would be disrupting the status quo, I would argue that things are changing in terms of the both sides of the fence are not, or at least are now gradually repudiating it. So meaning to say, as much as we want to avoid the geopolitical scenarios unfolding in the Taiwan Strait, but because Taiwan and also China, the People's Republic of China, are now gradually repudiating the 1992 consensus, I think the Philippines is now trying to make sense of its interests out there. Although the Department of Foreign Affairs, since the Aquino III period, tried to make sense of our One China policy, I think the Duterte and now the Marcos Jr. administration is trying to make inconvenient adjustments if you may, regarding this one, because if you would recall back in 2013, the Aquino III administration had a collusion with the Taiwanese fishers, which really made the Taiwanese people indignant and using the OFWs or overseas Filipinos as a weapon, an economic warfare against the Taiwanese. So there's really a lot to unpack in terms of the people-to-people relations and economic diplomacy, how be it informal, right? So since the Aquino presidency, you have the idea that the Philippines is now recognizing that Taiwan should not be forgotten as a player here in this regional stage. So moving forward, you have the 2016 arbitral ruling now during the presidency of Rodrigo Duterte. We have to remember that the Republic of China, Taiwan, repudiated the 2016 arbitral ruling. For them, it is because of the ambiguities happening in the Taiwan Strait and because of the heated geopolitical developments in the South China Sea, for Taiwan, Manila's victory, legal victory, if you may, is not acceptable because any move that would make the Philippines much more advantageous, legally speaking, would be at their loss. So that's also one of the problems that the Philippines is trying to make sense with. So now with the Marcos Jr. administration moving forward, so you have the collision, the repudiation of the Taiwanese regarding the ruling. Now you have this interesting development by which the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which is now in expanded under Marcos Jr., is being according to the media coverages, is that it's going to be used for a Taiwan scenario. Meaning to say that despite the fact that we have certain differences with the Taiwanese, because of the U.S. alliance, it seems that you have the U.S. the Americans' ability to connect all of its allies and partners all together. So there's a dynamic that makes things more complex for the Philippines foreign policy elites. You have on the one hand that they are also China, but on the other hand, they are also a benefactor of the American security umbrella. And then you have People's Republic of China, which claims that Taiwan is part of their territory, however, a renegade province. And then you also have China trying to make certain ambitious expansions in the South China Sea. So as I try to make sense of this with you, I'm also part of the narrative that tries to make sense of how are we going to make sense of Taiwan as part of the geopolitical development.
Thank you for that background. And I just wanted to dive into a little bit more on the complex relationship between the Philippines and the People's Republic of China. Just a few years ago, it seemed that Manila was poised to greatly expand its ties with Beijing, with then President Rodrigo Duterte openly reaching out to the PRC. While things have changed, obviously, and certainly evolved, I'd be curious to hear about what led to Duterte's outreach to China and what did he hope to achieve?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. Now, back in 2012, what's the problem? There was the Scarborough Shoal crisis, right? So you have the Aquino III administration trying to negotiate with the Chinese when the Philippine naval forces arrested some of the Chinese surveillance ships who were trying to do surveillance for marine purposes in the Scarborough Shoal. They were able to board these vessels, but it became a diplomatic drama for both sides of the fence. What happened at the back door, at the frontline negotiations, was that we would agree that both of us, China and the Philippines, we have to mutually withdraw from the Scarborough Shoal. For the Americans, it is the way forward. We will not side with you, but we encourage that all parties must use diplomacy, bilateral resolution, as the way forward. So under the advice of the Americans, you have the idea that the Aquino III faithfully abide with the negotiations. The Filipino government, they did their best. They agreed with the negotiation. We will get out. But the problem was that the Chinese did not. They were, once the Filipino vessels withdrew, you have the Chinese staying. So on the part of the Philippines, it was a betrayal. Some critics here in the Philippines would try to argue that Aquino III administration was fool enough to trust the Chinese. Hence, one of the criticisms by the Duterte administration. For Duterte, Aquino's failed diplomacy and yet too much aggressive lawfare led to disastrous consequences. According to Rodrigo Duterte. So for the electoral campaign of Rodrigo Duterte back in 2016, that's part of his narrative, that the way forward is a calm and cool head, trying to appease China, not using the West Philippine Sea dispute as the subject of our bilateral relations, but rather using economic diplomacy, economic outreach as the way forward. Because I think under the advice of his advisors, I think what Duterte was trying to do was that he was going to use the interdependence card, meaning that we're gonna set aside the ruling, we're gonna set aside our dispute, we're gonna trade, we're going to increase our people-to-people relations under the assumption that in later time, mutual understanding, mutual exchange, increased interdependence economically would lead to a much more peaceful or amicable type of relations. But I think that's one of the false assumptions regarding the consequences of globalization. Because when you indeed make yourself interdependent with the other, you have the idea of much more vulnerability. And indeed, that was the shot that was fired during the time of Duterte. So Duterte annually went to China for economic outreach, trying to make China pledge on certain investments. And Duterte, I think, tried his best to make the Philippines part of the Belt and Road Initiative. Because if we could remember, I think the Aquino III administration was punished by excluding the Philippines as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. But Duterte was trying to make the Philippines as part of this Belt and Road Initiative. So what he did, his government basically did, was to try to make sense of on how are we, the Filipinos, would be able to maximize certain investment from the Chinese. But the problem was that compared to Japanese or at least American investments, which relies on transparency, good governance, the Chinese did not rely on those models. For the Chinese model, just we'll give you this money and then just pay with certain interests. And this made resonance with the Duterte administration, because if we could remember, the Duterte administration is known for their firebrand and strongman performative politics. It resonated with the Chinese model of economic development. So you have certain pledges, you have certain investments, and what did that result into? It resulted in certain investments that overlook the certain fiscal disciplinary requirements. For example, the certain dams here in the Philippines were repudiated of trying to do oversight, because certain indigenous communities complained when these Chinese invested development dam projects were being invested, certain indigenous peoples were displaced along the way. So this was a very hurtful element in the Philippine society. So, but what's more hurtful, I think, for the Philippines is that not every pledges were able to take fruition. They were all promises. Much of these, I think 20%, 20 out of the 100% of the certain pledges were only took fruition. And this is not to be compared with the Japanese investments, which I think provides much more competitive and much more reliable material in terms of material quality. of investment for infrastructure. So there's a lot to unpack again, if you would observe in my explanation. But the point was that Duterte made certain outreach under the assumption that when we do trade, when we do people-to-people relations, perhaps we're going to forget that we have problems in the West Philippine Sea. However, that was not the point. It was business as usual. And in fact, the Duterte administration unintendedly, I think, strengthened or only emboldened the Chinese in terms of expanding their hold in the Philippines. Because for them, if you look at the geopolitical or the geostrategic map of the PLA of planners, right? You have the Philippines as part of the first island chain. They need a strong power of opinion from the Filipinos so that they would so that the Filipinos won't be able to impede the certain Chinese plans in the first island chain. So you have Duterte trying to avoid war, and you have China trying to cap on the opportunity of using gray zone strategies in the first island chain.
I just wanted to further expand on that point. Obviously, the current president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., has been far more critical of China compared to his predecessor. And it's very evident that Manila's foreign policy has seen the shift away from China. I just wanted to ask, what are the reasons for this shift? And what does the current administration want to achieve with these foreign policies?
The answer has two levels. You have the international and you have the domestic level considerations. Now, let's talk about the international. During the time of the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, it was the height of the pandemic. But the problem was that instead of us witnessing the Chinese holding or taking a pause from its aggressive actions, it was business as usual, right? So you have China not disturbed by the wrath of the COVID-19 pandemic. So the Philippines was having problems of lockdowns and the disruption of supply chains. Yet you have the Chinese doing what they do as usual. And this forced Rodrigo Duterte in his later years to actually reverse his decision to cancel the Visiting Forces Agreement. The VFA is arguably a very vital legal instrument as part of the U.S. alliance, because without the VFA, the American forces would not be able to get in here without having a legal ease in terms of entry. Okay, so when the time in the half of the 2020, you have the continued or the usual business as usual of Chinese activities, Duterte was forced, in terms of reversing the VFA, trying to revive the alliance under the advice of his political appointees in the cabinet in defense and foreign affairs. And then in October 2020 and also in October 2021, you have Rodrigo Duterte himself recognizing the ruling before the UN General Assembly, right? So it was a very significant event for the Philippine foreign policy development. Because you have a very anti-American, hated by the UN, hated by the West, and yet you have Rodrigo Duterte admitting that the 2016 arbitral ruling is vital, right? So this is at least the international dimension that provided strategic effect for the Marcos Jr. administration. It's as if that the Marcos Jr. administration realized that repeating the Duterte kind of foreign policy would be a mistake. So that is at least the international dimension. The domestic dimension has an historical and contemporary sub-dimension. When I say the historical dimension, Marcos Jr. would likely want to emulate his father, Marcos Sr., right? So because in 1970s, it's not really a conventional wisdom. It was actually Marcos Sr. was first to operationalize the need to occupy certain features in the West Philippine Sea. It was during his time in the 1970s that the Philippine Marines and Philippine Navy were able to detach certain units to occupy the Pag-asa Island. It was an important development for the Philippines' territorial claims, because at that time the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea wasn't yet signed, right? It took 1982 to finally to complete it. So basically, in Marcos Sr.'s time, there was a need to solidify the Philippine maritime territory. Fast forward, Marcos Jr., it seems that if we could remember his electoral campaign, he would likely want to put a nostalgia on the greatness of his father. We could argue that as far as there is a Duterte political alliance, there you have him providing a nostalgia of during the time of his father, right? That promising that if you vote for me, it would be a renaissance of the golden age, if you may, of the Philippine foreign policy with regard to the West Philippine Sea. Now, you have the contemporary dimension. We talk about his alliance with the Dutertes. We have the Vice President, Sara Duterte, part of the PDP Laban, political party of the former President Rodrigo Duterte. So it was a very convenient move for Marcos Jr. to ally himself with Sara Inday Duterte. But the point is this, he would not be able to do or bring back the renaissance of his father's foreign policy had it not been for his alliance with the Dutertes. But I think this is the trade-off of his political alliance with the Dutertes, because the Dutertes are not really that supportive of his move towards intensification of EDCA. But it was a needed move on the part of Marcos Jr. Fast forward, February 2022, weeks after the laser tagging of China's naval security vessels in the South China Sea, you have the move of Marcos Jr. administration towards the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. We needed to expand that agreement so that we would be able to add more facilities by which American forces would be able to rotate in this archipelago, so that we would be able to operationalize the commitments of the Mutual Defense Treaty. So there you have it. You have the international, you have the local, and the local, which are historical and contemporary sub-dimensions.
Well, Joshua, I think that's a great overview of what's clearly an incredibly complicated relationship between the Philippines and the People's Republic of China. You know, I think like a lot of other countries, not just in the region, but around the world, Manila has to walk a difficult line between balancing between the United States, the PRC, other interests. I don't think that's going to get any simpler in the near term or the long term. But given that this is a conversation about Taiwan specifically, I do want to turn to the other side of the Taiwan Strait and talk a bit about how the Philippines approaches Taiwan, how it views Taiwan in its broader strategic outlook. You know, I think so far as we've been talking, Taiwan has come up and Taiwan has been mentioned kind of tangentially or in sort of glancing fashion. But I'd love to get a bit more specific and hear your thoughts on the current state of Philippine-Taiwan relations. You know, is there interest in Taiwan within the Philippine government? And how does the Philippine government view Taiwan?
That's a great question. Right now, Taiwan is part of our consideration. It's part of our strategic calculus. But there are certain complexities. We cannot talk to them directly. We cannot talk to their president because we recognize the One China policy. They are there. They're near. But geopolitically, they're out there and they're far from our normal diplomatic conversation. So what we try to do is that we play low-key in terms of where you have Taiwan doing the new southbound policies since 2016. They're trying to reach out to certain Southeast Asians for economic diplomacy or people-to-people relations. We try to bank on those ideas. We try to bank on those items. For example, you have 200,000+ overseas Filipino, not just workers, but also exchange students, right? And also business groups investing, doing business with the Taiwanese companies, right? So semiconductor, wheat, linen, things like that, textiles, right? So you have certain economic interdependence. And by the way, the Philippines' top 9 trading partner is Taiwan. So we cannot leave Taiwan out of the situation. Geoeconomically, Taiwan is part of the calculus, but geopolitically, that's one that has been left out. So what the Philippines tries to do is that we have the Manila Economic and Cultural Office, and you also have the Taiwan Economic and Cultural Office, the MECO and the TECO. They're not embassies, but they are institutions by which we pursue our economic diplomacy and people-to-people ties. So that's what we try to do. There's no political security conventions that we try to push forward. But interestingly, the Philippine Coast Guard and the Taiwanese Coast Guard has had recent informal talks regarding formal unreported and unregulated fishing, collision considerations as part of the talks. But if you look at our conversations with them, it seems like more of a track 1.5 diplomacy, not necessarily track 1 intergovernmental diplomacy. So there's a lot to unpack here, but what I'm trying to say is that we look at the low political dimensions by which we are too much interdependent, but we are so much careful not to try to agitate China in this regard. So I think what's happening here right now is that we are concerned with the Taiwanese scenario geopolitically because of our concerns geoeconomically. So the primary concern, should there be a Taiwan scenario, and this is one of my favorite scenarios in my wargaming simulations with my students, is that how are we going to, for example, say, rescue our trapped overseas Filipino workers, exchange students and business groups inside the island nation, right? And at the same time, try to contain China as it expands in the first island chain. So let me reiterate. We have developing geopolitical concerns because it's rooted in its geoeconomic considerations with Taiwan.
That's great. I'm glad you brought up the potential for Philippine involvement and some sort of potential Taiwan Strait contingency. You know, earlier this year, President Marcos Jr. argued that it'd be hard to imagine the Philippines avoiding involvement in a potential Taiwan Strait conflict, given the Philippines' proximity to the Taiwan Strait and ties with the United States. Be curious to hear, one, you know, do you have a sense of what President Marcos meant by this statement? And maybe more specifically, is this something that Manila is really planning for? Is this a Taiwan Strait contingency really factoring into Manila's geopolitical considerations for the region and how it sees its role in the region?
What I try to make sense with Marcos Jr.'s statement that we cannot avoid is it's a message to the elites here in the Philippines, and at the same time, a message to its partners in the region. So let me start with the partners in the region. It's a signal to the Americans that yes, we are no longer distanced with this issue. We're no longer detached with this issue. We're not disaffected. We are affected because of the intensifying great power competition. And that if the lessons in the war of Ukraine tells us that spillovers can happen, wars are bloody, wars are long, if you look at the situation in Ukraine. So we're looking at certain playbooks. And I think Marcos Jr. is trying to convey to the Americans most especially that, yes, we now recognize this, yet I think you Americans would have to step up as the leader of this rules-based international order. It's a sending of message that we are ready, yet we are wary, right? So let me repeat that. We are ready, but we are wary. So moreover, you have the message towards the local elites. It's really a hard pill to swallow for the local elites that, you know, we have not been involved in the internal affairs, or should I say the cross-strait relations, right? We've been doing this for a long time. You have the first, second, and third strait crisis. Back then, it was the 1996. We're not so much affected because we believe that China did not have any capabilities to try to strike the American forces during that time, right? But things are different now. What made it different is that Marcos Jr. is trying to tell us that, hey guys, things are much different now. We no longer live in the 20th century. We no longer live in the 1990s, whereby globalization is the hype of today. Things are much, much different. And I hope this, I'm trying to personify Marcus Jr. on this one, right? So you have Marcus Jr. trying to tell the elites that things are changing and we need to accept this. But that's the problem, because some certain elites here, especially the Dutertes, would try to deny that, you know, confronting China would be in the interest of the Filipinos. For them, the interest, at least the critics of Marcus Jr., the Philippine interest lies on doing good trading relations with China, which is something polarizing, actually. For the past years, this kind of narrative has been polarizing for many, not just general elites, but also for us academicians, those who belong to the think tank organizations, those who belong to the general elites. You know, I was once part of the defense sector, and despite the fact that they honored the commander-in-chief, yes, he was the commander-in-chief, yet they recognize that what their commander-in-chief is trying to say is detrimental. You know, in Philippine politics, the military has always been an instrument of Philippine political development. But what I really am admiring about the Philippine military right now is that they were able to stand on their ground, professionally speaking, and yet that they were able to repudiate the orders of the president, right? To try and, should I say, ignore the moves of China. Because despite the foreign policy rhetoric of the president, the former president Duterte, the military stood their ground. And this is, I think, what Marcus Jr. is trying to cap on. The military, knowing that this is the mood of the military, domestic politics speaking, this is a good move. Supporting what the military wants in times, especially when the sovereignty of the country is imperiled, you have this convergence. It's politically convenient at the domestic level, and it is politically necessary at the international level.
I just wanted to highlight what you just said there, the kind of attitude and mentality of being ready but wary. And I think that's a phrase or an attitude that's been very much what the Philippines has been pursuing in their policies regarding security. And I just wanted to ask, how has that mentality been reflected in the policy towards the Taiwan Strait? And how have the people in the Philippines reacted to this?
I think this is very much reflected on, you know, we still don't have a national security strategy. The former national security advisor, Dr. Clarita Carlos, wasn't able to provide us a very solid strategy or ways forward, because what the former security advisor wanted was more trading relations, interdependence, low politics conversations with China, on which, on the contrary, this is not what's happening on the ground. It was an idealism. So what happened was that we were backtracked in our security sector. We weren't able to produce a security strategy. Right now, under the current leadership of National Security Advisor Eduardo Anyo, I think the government is trying to consolidate much more solid inputs on the way forward. Right now, we're still waiting. What is the way forward? What are the necessary ways and means that we need to cap on? What are the multi-year commitments of the Philippines? This is the current dynamic of the political conditions right now. We're all waiting. Yes, you have EDCA. Yes, the continued AFP modernization. But what do you specifically want to do, right? So we're really trying to hope that there's so many foreign trips. You know, Marcus Jr. has had several foreign trips out there. We're just hoping that these are all integral of his security strategy. So basically, we're all waiting. And that related in relation to my point on the public sentiment, the general public is worried. We recognize that this is something that we cannot avoid. We can no longer reverse the developments right now. We are geopolitically affected, but we are worried. I think the reason why we are worried is because of the lack of solid ways forward. Again, let me reiterate, you have EDCA, that's good. You have continued AFP modernization. That's good. We have the continuous narrative that we won the arbitral ruling. That's good. But I think the Filipinos want a more clear direction. We want a clearer direction on the ways forward and how are we going to do it. And to be fair with Marcos Jr., this is a very difficult time for the 21st century international system. Things are multipolar, meaning that there are, aside from US and China, there are other power blocs trying to forge their way on. You have the ASEAN, for example, Indonesia. You have the European Union joining here in the Indo-Pacific, trying to do maritime security partnerships with us. There are a lot of players beyond US and China. To be fair with the Marcos Jr. administration, this is a very difficult time. Nevertheless, as a republic, as a democracy, the Filipinos are waiting because they are ready, yet they are worried because of the lack of direction. What we need as a bottom line is hopefully we could release a national security strategy this year so that we could provide the ways forward. So what are the impediments? I think the domestic political considerations. By next year, you have the midterm elections, right? Things are changing in the local political scene. And this provides us a lot of difficulty in trying to move forward because I don't think that Marcos Jr. would be able to secure his seat to revive the Marcos Sr. legacy without the help of Duterte's. And it's going to give Marcos Jr. a lot of hard time, but he's still the president. He has a lot of political capital right now. So what I hopefully want him to do is, you know, if he really wants to push for a renaissance, if you may, of the Philippines foreign policy, he has to be much more decisive than what he's currently doing. We need a much more proactive middle power, as we say, for the Philippines.
Well, to conclude the conversation, I do want to look forward a little bit. And I want to build on what you've just been talking about. You know, throughout this conversation, you've made it very clear that the Marcos administration and really any Philippine administration is going to face difficult questions going forward. You know, this is not the more simple world of a sort of the unipolar, bipolar world of the past. It's really a more multipolar international system where countries around the world are forced to make really difficult, challenging decisions about how to align themselves, how to, you know, build coalitions and work together when there's so much uncertainty. And I think the United States is not immune to that. And, you know, I think in recent years has made more of an effort to invest in the Indo-Pacific, to build up its presence in the region and build ties with regional partners like South Korea, like Japan, like the Philippines. And I think recently we've seen more of an effort to, you know, build up ties with Taiwan, increase resilience and, you know, increase deterrence in the Taiwan Strait, not just bilaterally between the United States and Taiwan, but more multilaterally, trying to engage other partners on, you know, ensuring prosperity in the region and ensuring that Taiwan has potential support from other countries in the region. And I'm curious, you know, as the Philippines faces these difficult questions, is there more the United States can do to help the Philippines make these decisions, to help make these decisions easier and help get the Philippines on board in potential, you know, multilateral cooperative agreements, you know, getting the Philippines to engage more with partners in the region and get on board potentially with U.S. efforts to strengthen deterrence in the Taiwan Strait?
I think what is lacking in the American security umbrella is the economic front. I'm actually waiting for the Indo-Pacific economic framework, you know, for mutual prosperity of its friends, partners, and allies. What is lacking, to be honest, with all, to put this bluntly, is the economic front. Because right now, the Philippines' top trading partner, it's China. It's not the United States. But if we really want to choose a side, I think the Americans has to do a lot to in terms of trying to convince the entire Southeast Asian community it's a way forward, you know. So with regard to, just imagine this one. You look at the Taiwan scenario, China would invade, there would be a humanitarian catastrophe. The South China Sea supply chain would be dismantled, right? What are the options that we would take, right? The Filipinos are wary of its developmental concerns. We are trying to revive our economy from the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're going to face a decade-long inflation right now. So that's one of the elements that I think the Americans would need to convince. I think the EDCA, the security, the military umbrella, I think they're doing fine in terms of the assurance. We need that assurance, and the EDCA is a terrific instrument to make that happen. Yet, the Filipinos, the Filipino elite and the Filipino general public would remain on the developmental side of concern. So, at the end of the day, if the Americans would want to preserve its status quo, bring prosperity. Yes, the American military capability is good, the diplomatic clout and capital is good, but the economic leg of the alliance has to be complemented in that regard. We cannot rely on China on anything. And if anything, I think the Americans, if should there be any lacking on the part of the Americans, I think there needs to be a diplomatic revival on part of the Americans in trying to forge a strong economic framework to make all of its partners, economic partners in the Indo-Pacific, to bolster their economic capabilities, to try and trade with each other, you know, less risky, more secure cybersecurity framework, a much more safer digitalized economy, a much more secured supply chain in the sea lane of communications, things like that. So in other words, if you want us to be on board, fully on board, and trying to build a rules-based order, those rules will have to be advantageous for not just for Filipinos, but for the entire Southeast Asian community. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think this is a great place to bring the conversation to a close. You've made it really clear that all the major actors in this conversation, from the Philippines, the United States, the PRC, Taiwan, currently face difficult questions and are going to continue to face difficult questions going forward as they seek to kind of chart a path through really uncertain and volatile times. You've also made it really clear the United States plays a huge role in this. And, you know, as much as the United States says that they're interested in investing more heavily in the region, developing sort of multilateral mechanisms to help potentially push back against Chinese influence and increase deterrence in the Taiwan Strait, and there's a lot of substance that needs to emerge. You know, there's a lot of more concrete detail that nations in the region, particularly the Philippines, need to really help simplify their decision making and get on board with more cooperative efforts. I think you've done a great job of providing background on nuance on the factors that are shaping Manila's decision-making. And you've also made it clear that there are a lot of pre-existing affinities between the Philippines and Taiwan. There's a lot of people-to-people ties, economic ties. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how things unfold going forward in terms of both the Philippines' relationship with the United States, but also its relationship with Taiwan. But again, I'm very excited that you could join us today and provide your expertise. So thank you so much for joining us today, Joshua.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with really every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, as well as our frequent public seminars and other programs. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.